You're listening to the Bottom Line podcast, where those living with or beyond bowel cancer, as well as health professionals involved in bowel cancer treatment and care, share their inspirational stories and lived experiences with host and bowel cancer survivor, Stephanie.
I am super excited to be chatting today with clinical geneticist, Professor Ingrid Winship. Ingrid's career has combined clinical practice, biomedical research, and the translation of research into practice and policy. While she works across many domains within clinical genetics, Ingrid's research interests have been focused around colorectal cancer, or more commonly known as bowel cancer. She is also the inaugural chair of the Adult Clinical Genetics at the University of Melbourne and Royal Melbourne Hospital. Ingrid, I'm so delighted to have you join me today on the Bottom Line podcast.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very passionate about the work that we do. And what we do is about empowering people and trying to prevent predictable complications and keep healthy people healthy. And genomics, genetic testing, genetic counselling, risk assessment and risk management are the cornerstones of that kind of preventive strategy.
Absolutely. And I love how you say about empowering people. We talk about that a lot at Bowel Cancer Australia across many domains. For the layperson, I suppose, and before we get into that nitty-gritty, because it's such an exciting area, could you just take me through a little bit of what you do as a clinical geneticist?
So my qualification is firstly as a doctor, medical doctor, and then a specialization. And so a lot of people think about genetics in terms of pediatrics and children with special needs. And of course, they play a very important role in diagnosis and management and assisting children and their families. I work in the world of adults. So I'm an adult trained person. In fact, I'm a dermatologist by training. And there are lots and lots of inherited skin disorders. And there are lots of skin signs that actually lead you to understand something about internal cancers. So taking a holistic approach to healthcare, you can come into this kind of arena from any kind of background because your genetics may have an impact on more than one part of your body. So I'm a physician, a clinical geneticist, so I work only with adults. When I was younger and there were fewer geneticists, and in New Zealand I was the only one for a while in my region, you have to basically do everything. What I have done is create a genetic service here at the Royal Melbourne based on the needs assessment of the community that we serve. And familial cancer is a really important part of what we do. Just for context, we also have large clinics for inherited neurological disorders, for cardiac disorders. Very sad, there are conditions that cause sudden, unexpected cardiac death, and we can work with families for understanding and preventing this happening again in a family. So it's important to consider genetics in a holistic way. But when we think about the bowel cancer risk, what we do, and I do a combined clinic with a gastroenterologist, a couple of genetic counselors, a couple of trainees, and what we do is assess whether someone has a higher likelihood of an inherited component to their cancer. I'll rewind that a little bit. Most bowel cancer is not inherited because of one single genetic problem, but some is. And so one of the things that we need to do is try and understand how much of the cancer is on the basis of heredity. In other words, the genes that a parent passes to their children and that you can pass on to your children, and how much is environmental. And the real answer is that whatever proportion there is, there's always going to be some sort of interplay between genes and the environment.
So for me, for example, I did the genetic test for Lynch syndrome, but me having had bowel cancer at 42, my son will have to start having colonoscopies early. Should he have genetic screening as well?
Well, if a parent has a cancer and they have appropriate genetic testing and there is no variant found, then if you don't have a variant, you can't pass it on. Of course, when we see an individual, we always think about the kids as well, and remembering that half the genes come from the other parent. And you can do a big risk assessment on half the family and don't forget about the other half. So we are always happy to review. And I see lots of people like yourself whose kids are young and say, I'm not going to give you advice on your child now, but let's review him or her at 25 or 30 or 10 years younger than you were at the onset of your cancer, so that kids can be the beneficiary of all the new knowledge that we will generate between now and when they need it. If I gave you advice now, I guarantee it would be out of date.
Such a dynamic world, isn't it?
The only thing that I can be sure of is that they will need to have something. So it's not a case of they're 15, 17 now, they're too young. Don't need anything yet, but they will need more than the general population. So if you're young when you have bowel cancer, even if there's no genetic variant found, even if we don't find a single gene that's responsible for that increased vulnerability to cancer, because of your young age, your children should have extra care.
So along the cancer journey then, when would someone see a geneticist?
So that all depends on individual and family history. So let's take somebody who has bowel cancer. The red flags, so having said that most cancer is not inherited, the red flags are the type of cancer, where in the bowel it is, some of the cellular content, the immunohistochemistry, whether it looks like genes aren't working or not from the laboratory tests on the actual tumor. But age is also a very important factor. Family history is an important factor. And then other collateral information. So, for instance, if there are some skin signs associated with Lynch syndrome, there are some eye signs associated with familial polyposis. So it's taking a holistic look at the individual, drilling down into how much can the tumor actually tell us about what's going on, and then looking back into the family and looking to see if there are other red flags. I have quite a low threshold for genetic testing, particularly in young people, because that information is important not only in the management of the individual now, but potentially in risk management later, and also extending out to their families. But even more, taking predictive testing. So, if you find a genetic variant in one of the cancer predisposition genes in an individual, their first degree relatives can all have that testing. Now, generally in young adults, it would be their brothers and sisters and parents, and maybe cascading out to cousins and further through what we call predictive testing to see if the gene is present, and then putting what I call a health safety net, a management plan in place, all based on evidence. We can't speculate, we can't just experiment. We need to work with evidence so that we're giving people the best options. In general, where there's a young onset bowel cancer, the kids are still young. And so, generally speaking, this is not a disease of childhood. But if there was one message that I would want to leave you with, nobody's too young to be considered. And I would like to see a health system where nobody's ever fobbed off again for being too young for something.
Yes.
That probably resonates
It
with
does
you.
resonate, I personally, but also we say, our Never Too Young campaign at Bowel Cancer Australia and, even diagnosis, oh, you're too young. How often have we heard that?
Exactly. So while it is international best practice not to test children, say for Lynch syndrome, where generally the screening only starts at, depending on what gene is involved, around 25, give the children the innocence of youth. There's nothing in it for a child to know about something they might get as an adult, where there is potential for prejudice against them. Attitudinal, societal, we'll talk a bit about insurance as well. Being told when you're a child that you have a gene that has a variant in it that might have implications for you later on doesn't have a lot of benefit for the child. If there is benefit, so for instance, in familial polyposis, where the polyps may develop earlier, we deal with that differently. So it's customizing the kind of care that we give, particularly to young people, but in such a way that they are empowered by that information, not terrified.
When you talk to people about genetics and having genetic testing, there is a camp that want to know, and then there's those that are terrified because they don't understand it and they fear that it will hold something terrible for them. How do you overcome that?
Well, it's very, very important that genetic testing is done with informed consent and with appropriate counselling. And counselling, a lot of people sort of say, well, I'm pretty tough, I don't need counselling. Counselling is not an admission of weakness. Counselling is a process that helps you to make sense of what's going on. And so if somebody wishes to have genetic testing, it's really important that they understand what a genetic test is. In general, it's a blood test. That's relatively easy. But it's what does that test tell you? How many genes are going to be tested? Is it a single gene? Are we going to look at 20 genes or 40 genes? Are we going to find things we weren't expecting? So, for instance, if I was doing a genetic test for someone of 42 with bowel cancer, I would do a test that looked at the bowel cancer genes. I would not do a test that added in neurodegenerative conditions because it's of no consequence in that scenario. Even if it's in the family, we work with that information so that we answer the clinical question as well as we can. Now, it's uncommon to do a single gene test because, having said that, most bowel cancer is not on the basis of a single gene. It's very difficult to look at a tumor and say it's this gene or that gene. The immunohistochemistry that we do, which is a test done on the tumor tissue and compared with the normal tissue around the tumor, gives us some clues as to Lynch syndrome and some ideas of which gene it might be. But even Lynch syndrome is not one disease. There are four major genes that predispose, and they've all got different risk profiles. It's important also to remember that with Lynch syndrome, there are also risks of gynecological cancers. And, we had International Women's Day a few days ago, and I think it's really important that women's health is brought to the forefront. And Lynch syndrome has for a long time been thought about as a bowel cancer syndrome. It is a bowel and gynae cancer syndrome, and we have to remember that. And so, women who've been through the Lynch journey often need to have the services of a gynae oncologist. They might need surveillance, they might need even risk reducing surgery. So, again, prior to testing, understanding what the steps are for the test, but if this gene comes back positive, what does that mean for you? What does it mean for your family? If it comes back negative, what does it mean for you? What does it mean for your family? Because a negative gene test is not no information, it's useful information. It's putting it into the context of yourself, your family, and your life. Always thinking, how can we predict where this person may be going? How can we make their journey safer?
Yes, I think again, it comes back to that empowering piece, doesn't it? Which is where a genetic counsellor also comes in, doesn't it? To help navigate the jargon and how the effects of the test will be.
So genetics is a field filled with jargon. I don't like jargon. I don't mind technical terms, but technical terms need always to be explained. So, I could say your first degree relatives and you'd say, what is that? But if I said your close relatives, your brothers, sisters, parents, children, everybody knows what that means. And people are inherently smart. We understand the concept of a familial situation. The first thing that people say when a new baby is born is, who does it look like? You know,
Yes.
it's got dad's nose and mum's ears, and you
It's the
know.
first thing we think about with genes, isn't it?
Well, exactly. And so people inherently understand the familial nature of the world. And so it's not difficult with everybody to work in such a way that you can take the concepts of genetics, which might be a bit complex and jargonistic, and turn them into everyday language. Because if somebody's going to submit to testing and put out their arm and have their blood taken and get that result, they need to know and understand. But it's your body and your will. And so if you want to take a bit of time to think about genetic testing, that's fine. There's no, well, you've got to do it today or the opportunity's going to go away. And I would venture that if you did a genetic test on everybody who came to the clinic, we would be
Inundated.
inundated, yes, but we don't ever want to be pushy or coercive. If somebody is ambivalent, if they say, well, not sure how my mum would feel, you know, she might feel guilty, not sure how my kids, you know, my kids are now 22 and 24, will they battle to get mortgage insurance? How will they feel? You know, there are new relationships. How do you broach this with a new partner? So it's important to consider everything in the melting pot because no two individuals are the same. And no issues raised in that sort of scenario are right or wrong. It's what's a good fit for that individual.
Can you have genetic testing then? I think you've alluded to this, but at any point along the journey, even after you've finished your cancer treatment?
Yeah, so your genome, your what I call your constitutional DNA. So, quick biology lesson: mum produces an egg, dad produces a sperm. Each one has got one single copy of the 20,000 genes which we need to be healthy. So, egg and sperm each contribute half the genes, fuse together to form an embryo, which then divides and divides and divides. And then starts turning into arms and legs and brains and this sort of thing. Now, from that first embryo, all the cells are the same. So, all the DNA that you're going to have, that's your germline, your blueprint, your constitution, are present at the moment of conception and then should be faithfully reproduced throughout your life. So, we can then test. Any at any time, which is why, you know, for a long time tests have been done on, you know, 12-week unborn babies to see if they have serious conditions. Tests are done on children, tests are done on old people. In fact, we can even with sudden cardiac death, we can even do tests after someone has passed away, if we don't know why, what we call a molecular autopsy. So that DNA is unchanged. So the DNA in a tumor, and this is something that a lot of people get confused with. We do a lot of somatic testing. Somatic means of the cells. So within a tumor, you might get lots of different genetic changes, which are the reason why that tumor has developed. But they're not heritable. They're not in the DNA that you got from mum and dad, and they're not in the DNA that you've passed on to your kids. So, in general, somatic testing is just in the tumor. Sometimes, and that's very useful, and it can be very useful, particularly with targeted treatments now, where the medical oncologist might use a specific drug to target those gene changes in the tumor. Sometimes we see a gene change in a tumor that actually looks like it may have been inherited as well. And then we'll go back and do a blood test and do a test of the constitutional or germline genetics to see whether it's an inherited phenomenon as well as everything else going on in the tumor. Because ultimately, cancers can be the result of lots of genetic changes, but those have happened after life, not at the time of conception. As opposed to what you inherit, whether it's blue eyes, freckles, or a genetic predisposition to bowel cancer. those are there and can be tested. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Absolutely. I think that clarity is really important. I'd like you to expand a little bit around the testing of the tumor and how that can help you with your treatment options.
Yeah, so that's really the work of a medical oncologist, not a clinical geneticist. It's very important, and as we move forwards and get more drugs and more targeted drugs, testing the tumor for markers and genetic changes may take a medical oncologist into a different phase of treatment, maybe not the first phase, but maybe the second phase. So all of treatment is potentially changed. So, if I go back to Lynch syndrome, for a long time now, and I remember writing a paper on this when I was still in New Zealand, which was like 20 years ago. If you think that a person has Lynch syndrome, you will do more extensive surgery than if it's a bowel cancer that doesn't look like Lynch syndrome. So, for instance, you might have a right hemicolectomy as opposed to a segmental resection. And that's obviously a surgical decision. And we do try and help the surgeons so that the surgery is optimized to your needs. And then if there's chemotherapy to be had or immunotherapy, the new therapies coming in, immunotherapy is very excited because it kickstarts your own body into treating. Carries some side effects. It's not an easy journey, but certainly something worth considering. And again, not for everyone. It depends on the tumor. So we talk about precision medicine, and this is where we're heading. Rather than just crashing and doing the same thing for everybody, weighing up the pros and cons, looking at the tumor, looking at yourself, looking at the family, putting that whole picture together. And once you've got all the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, you'll get a clearer picture. It's easier to take that definitive approach to treatment. And then where I come in at the end is saying, well, what's the likelihood of another tumor? Is there a risk of another primary tumor? Is there a risk of another kind of tumor? So, for instance, I've mentioned Lynch syndrome and gynae cancers. With polyposis, there's a risk of thyroid cancer. So it's making sure that the safety net is tight enough woven and wide enough that you don't fall around the outsides. And that's important for the individual who's had cancer, as well as for their families.
The developments that are happening so fast.
Absolutely.
How do you keep ahead of the game?
My first job in clinical genetics was in 1983. So obviously, I'm an old
You
chook.
don't look that old for our listeners. She looks fantastic.
I've got a shield up over my. My job nowadays is nothing like my job, 30, 40 years ago. Safe to say that people are still people. And the most important part of everything we do is to be person focused. In genetics, we extend that to the family. So we must never, ever lose sight of the individual. And the patient may not actually be sick. They may be concerned about their risk. And one of the things that I see a lot of is young people who may have lost a parent as a child or who have a sibling who's had a young onset cancer. Sometimes people don't want to talk to their siblings because they feel my brother or sister has gone through this journey and they're getting on with their lives. I want to get an objective view, but I don't want to trouble them and make them relive their journey because let's face it, the journey's pretty hard and reliving it is not easy for anybody. So it is a difficult situation when you have a family history and you have to ask people about relatives and a lot of loss and a lot of grief. But it's important to get as much information as possible. There's two ways of looking at this, and I'm have always been an academic and worked in the public sector where the entitlement to healthcare is based on eligibility, which is, I guess, a very fair way of looking at it. But one of the problems is that we don't have enough resources for everybody. And eligibility can become quite elastic. I now do a little bit of private work, and this is because I've been asked to do this because there are people who have an increased risk of cancer, but not in the high risk that would get you into a family cancer clinic. It's not a criticism of the eligibility criteria, but rather a resource implication, and that people who would like to know about their risks can't know because nobody will help them. What we really need is genetics and genomics being put into the mainstream of healthcare so that more healthcare professionals are empowered to do that kind of testing, to know what to ask you and what the pitfalls are, what the pros and cons are, so that more doctors can request genetic testing without having to go through a genetic service. Essentially, I'm trying to do my craft group out of a job, but if we did our jobs really well, we would empower other doctors to do this kind of testing. And so for bowel cancer, for ovarian cancer, for endometrial cancer, for breast cancer, common cancers, but seen uncommonly in particularly young people or in large family groups, I would like to see those practitioners immediately doing genetic testing themselves. So it's creating the dynamic, the resources, whether it's an online resource or something to read, your kind of podcasts, this sort of thing, that would give people the opportunity to have the information they seek in a framework that's safe for them, but without having to sit on a waiting list or be turned away.
I know from my sister, who's a genetic counsellor, the waiting lists are very long.
They're very long, and also a lot of people don't ever get on a waiting list. And again, this is not a criticism, but rather a statement of reality. It's extremely distressing to be told when you're worried that you don't meet eligibility criteria. Unfortunately, it turns into a user pays situation, and so only those who have the funds to pay for testing are able to have it. Which is also very distressing because healthcare should be for everyone. And you shouldn't be able to have more if you have more funds. So that does trouble me. But at the same time, those who can pay shouldn't be disempowered by just saying, no, well, nobody can have it. So it's a tricky one.
Absolutely. I'd like to just touch on the insurance piece because I think for a lot of people, I've had people in my community go, oh, I don't want to get genetic testing because I'm worried that my children then won't be able to get insurance. What's your take on that, Ingrid?
So I've been involved in this, from the start. In fact, I've been involved in cancer genetics since cancer genetics started. All of the genes that predispose to breast, bowel, ovarian, endometrial, renal, all these genes have been discovered in the course that I've been working as a clinical geneticist. So insurance is a very important issue, not necessarily impacts everyone, but those it impacts strongly. So until 2019, life insurance or rated insurance, that's life, income protection, dreaded disease, trauma policies, the underwriter could ask for results of genetic test and then use that in the calculation of a premium. Now, that seems patently unfair. Particularly when most of the people that come and see me for genetic testing are coming because they've got a family member who's had a cancer and they want to do whatever they can to reduce their risk. So fabulous health accountability. And then they try and buy a mortgage, buy a house and get a mortgage insurance. And somebody says, oh no, you can't be insured. And they knock them back. Now that is a distressing situation. So there's been a group working party. In 2019, a moratorium was put in place to say that life policies, rated insurance calculation may not include the results of genetic tests, but up to a threshold of $500,000 for life insurance and thresholds for the other insurance as well. And if you think about the size of your average 38-year-old's mortgage now, $500,000 is the threshold is too low.
Doesn't scratch the surface, does it?
It doesn't. So at least it's something. It's a step in the right direction. But again, with much hard work, and we actually had a group led out of Monash University by Paul Lekars and Jane Tiller. A bill has now been put to Parliament. Now, a law, changing a law takes a long time, but again, steps in the right direction. So that I would hope that kids who are kids now, by the time they're old enough to have a mortgage, won't have to think about that.
Let's hope that comes to fruition. We're coming to the end, Ingrid, but before we do, just a couple of things. In very broad terms, and you may have already touched on this, in terms of genetics, it does save lives. What would you like to see in the future for cancer patients?
Well, firstly, and I'll say this a million times, I don't want anybody ever again to be told that their symptoms may be suggestive of cancer, but they're too young, go away. I think that's the number one. The second thing is to people who are 45, call up and get your poo test. We've managed to bring the age back from 50 to 45, but you still have to initiate it yourself if you're young. And that's a really important target age group between 45 and 50. To those who are 50, when you get the test in the mail, do not put it on the fridge. It doesn't do anything on the fridge. You need to do it. And this is potentially life-saving. And we see people. And of course, any screening test is going to miss a few cancers, and lots of people will get a positive result and they'll have a colonoscopy and it'll be all clear. But what a happy result that is. But we don't want to overdo colonoscopy either because it's quite intrusive. So this poo test is a really, really, really good test and is life-saving. And so for those of you who get it in the mail, please do it. And for those who are 45 and over, you can have it for free. And for people who have a family history, anybody who's got bowel cancer in a close relative, sister, brother, father, mother, child, bowel cancer under 55 needs more attention than others. The single gene disorders are uncommon but real. Probably between 1 and 2% of people have an inherited predisposition to bowel cancer. So if you're worried about your family history, I guess the take-home message is there's no such thing as a silly question.
I think sometimes people get intimidated by medical situations and language, and it's hard enough navigating the system when you do know what you're talking about sometimes, as you and I know. But for those that have no medical understanding, it can be bamboozling, and it's good to be able to empower yourself to ask the questions.
Absolutely. And I think the important thing is as we train up, firstly, more genetic counselors, but all health professionals need to understand genetics and where it fits into healthcare and into the world. I teach a subject at the University of Melbourne, which is genetics, health and society, teaching students, not necessarily medical students, but students, what the societal implications of genomics are. And, they're really important. And as a community, as people get more educated, and I think the next generation learn much more about technology, have much more access to technology. Your average 5-year-old has an iPad. When I did school projects, we used to catch the bus to the city and go to the reference library and find books and journals and things like that. I actually did my doctorate without a computer. Probably would have done a better one if I, to later. But that's the point. There's things, the standards go up, but the rising tide lifts all the ships. And we want our population, we haven't scratched the surface on what it's like to be disempowered by social, constructs. Not everyone in our ecosystem has the same access. Not everyone has the same education. And so we need to be very egalitarian. and provide services that are accessible, empowering, and palatable to everyone.
Ingrid, thank you so much. I think we could chat all day, and I really appreciate you giving us the time today. I know we've only just scratched the surface on what is a very big and dynamic area, but I truly appreciate your time today on the Bottom Line podcast.
That's my absolute pleasure, and it'd be nice to chat again. And if you want other people to do podcasts, I can dob in lots of gorgeous people.
Thank you so much for listening to the Bottom Line podcast. To find out more about bowel cancer or for support or simply to donate, please go to bowelcanceraustralia.org.